So there's this wonderful thing where we assume that hiding our weaknesses is a beneficial thing to do. But actually, the psychology says that if we want to appear more competent, if we want to appear more likable, if we want to appear more persuasive, revealing a weakness can be very powerful.
What's the secret to becoming more likable and influential as a leader? How do we actually build and scale by appealing to our consumers in a sustainable way? Why are we more likely to eat that imperfect cookie? This week's episode will have you taking copious notes from Phil Agnew, a behavioral science expert and my podcast brother in the network, where he hosts one of the top marketing podcasts, Nudge, and shares tips of the trade you can start applying to, yes, win business and influence people today. You don't want to miss it. All right, so this is action for the editors. All right, we are recording with Phil. I am so excited, Phil, to have you on. So how are you? And tell me more about what you've been up to.
Yeah, I'm very good, Sarah. Thank you. What have I been up to? I have been working on my podcast a fair bit. So you and I are both part of the same podcast network, HubSpot Podcast Network. I run a show called Nudge. And on that show, I spend a lot of time interviewing people far, far smarter than me about behavioral science. So I've been spending a lot of time on that. And then my day job is working as a senior product marketer at a company called Buffer that helps with social media scheduling.
So we definitely have a marketing expert and consumer behavior analyst on the show here, which we don't have often. I've been following the show and tuning into a lot of your breakdowns and absolutely love so much of that, which I think can be brought to the world of business and venture capital, which is what we're all about here in Billion Dollar Moves. So I want to start, you know, in true Billion Dollar Moves fashion, Phil, in understanding what really brought you to this work. I mean, what was the fascination, that starting point for you in consumer behavior?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to what I studied at university. I studied marketing at university, which is a bit of a rogue thing for a marketer to do. Most come into marketing. They don't bother spending a lot of money to study it. But then I went into my first job and I found myself to be, honestly, largely useless at what I was doing. I was struggling to create copy that persuaded people. I was struggling to create subject lines that people open the emails to. I was struggling to do a lot of the tactical things that you need to do as a marketer to get results. And fortunately, fairly early on into my career, I stumbled upon the world of behavioral science, which is basically evidence-backed decision-making. So this is the world of psychology. We've spent hundreds of years trying to understand how people make decisions. And behavioral scientists have been unpacking this and sharing how people make decisions and the common biases that they have. And there's a whole world of consumer psychology upon which you can apply this stuff to marketing. And I found when I started to apply this stuff that my marketing was far more successful. So I became just like hooked on behavioral science. And I think today, and hopefully this is what we can talk about a lot of, is I think it's interesting far beyond just the realm of marketing. It's interesting in understanding the biases we all have, why we make certain decisions, why we're flawed with certain decision-making tactics. And this is useful to anyone, I believe, in business.
Absolutely. And I want to dig real deep here. When you started sort of looking at the different authors and going deep into this, what surprised you? I mean, was there a sort of a particular theory that comes to mind in what you didn't expect?
Yeah, I think one definitely stands out. So I always assumed that sharing a weakness was a bad thing to do. Revealing one of your flaws would make people doubt you, reduce their perception of your competence. You know, just didn't seem like a good thing to do. And then I read about these wonderful studies by a researcher called Elliot Aronson. And what he did in his research is he filmed an actor answering quiz questions correctly. And then he showed that video to a set of participants. The participants didn't know it was an actor. They thought it was somebody who was just very intelligent, answering lots of quiz questions correctly. And he filmed two versions of the video. One version, the actor gets all these questions right, walks off stage, that's it, end of video. Same. And then the second video, the actor gets all the same questions right and then goes to walk off stage but spills his coffee down himself. So spills coffee. So he basically reveals a weakness, the weakness being that he's a bit clumsy, you know, a bit unsure-footed. And when Elliot Aronson showed these two videos to sets of participants, so A-B test, where different people see different videos, and then asked them, how competent do you rate this individual? How likable do you rate this individual? He found that people rated the individual as far more likable and even more competent as well, even though they were revealing a flaw. And this study had been replicated in far more applicable areas like job interviews. So another area where I would have thought I should not show a weakness is a job interview. Yet Jo Silvester, in her study, I think in Swansea University in Wales, she got dozens of different research assistants to apply for jobs, but all share that they basically had a similar level of skills and experience. And so they would apply for these jobs, sending very, very similar CVs, usually under the same name. But some of the CVs would reveal a flaw, a weakness, and others would just solely talk about the strengths that the individual has. And she found that the individuals who showed that weakness, that flaw, were far more likely to get an interview, far more likely to progress to further rounds, far more likely to, you know, to continue and actually get the job. And so there's this wonderful thing where we assume that hiding our weaknesses is a beneficial thing to do. But actually, the psychology says that if we want to appear more competent, if we want to appear more likable, if we want to appear more persuasive, revealing a weakness can be very powerful. So that's one that I wish I'd known a bit earlier in my career.
Being really raw about who you are, does it create sort of trust? Is that the psychology in really being relatable, likable? Is that why as well? I mean, I'm jumping ahead here, but one of the concepts that you brought about was about the human characteristics that we put on brands as well to be more relatable. Does it come from trust? I was thinking a lot about that.
Yeah, so this effect is known as the Pratfall effect. And yeah, it's this idea that if you show a weakness, you boost lots of attributes about yourself. And it's, as you sort of alluded to, it's not just visible with people, it's visible with products as well. So cookies that have imperfect edges, they are liked more when shown to potential cookie eaters. This was a study done by Adam Ferrier in Australia. They're preferred by 66% to 44%.
Wow.
So cookies that look imperfect as well appear more likable. And I think if you think about that diligently, you realize, yeah, this is down to trust. When people see a cookie that doesn't look flawless, you think, oh, this must be homemade. I trust that this was created by hand. I trust that this is a genuine product created by someone, locally, rather than something that's mass produced. And yeah, the same as can be applied to humans. And of course, the same can be applied to major brands as well. Some of the most successful marketing is marketing that actually reveals a flaw. In the UK, there's a yeast extract spread called Marmite. And it's not famous for being a yeast extract spread. That's not particularly interesting. But Marmite's tagline for the past 50 years has been, you'll either love it or you'll hate it. So they prominently play on this idea that people really won't like this product. They will hate it. And by highlighting that, they make people trust their brand more, trust their marketing more, and are more likely to buy. Same can be said for the very famous, many of your listeners will know this one, the Avis campaign, where Avis, we're second, so we try harder. Now, all that does is add an element of trust, which makes people more likely to pick them. These are all real-world experiments, but there's one in a study which has been peer-reviewed, which is a fantastic one, which is where a waiter who is reading out the menu actively discourages one of the diners or some of the diners from eating one of the dishes. So if a waiter says, I really wouldn't get the lobster today, it's not fresh. What you find is in the scenarios where the waiter reveals a weakness in the menu, the waiter ends up getting a far, far larger tip. So the individual tends to do very well. So waiters listening, get the approval from your manager, but go and say that something on the menu is not very nice. And actually, the individuals who are dining tend to spend more as well. So they increase the amount they buy simply because they trust the restaurant far more. Think about it logically. If a restaurant's willing to tell you that one of their dishes isn't fresh, you're far more likely to think that the rest of their dishes must be incredibly good if they're willing to tell you something like that. So I think it is around this element of trust, boosting this element of trust, boosting this element of likability. And honestly, it's just a smart tactic that all of us can endorse. You know, revealing a flaw is a smart thing to do.
Yeah. Hold that thought. Teams everywhere are dealing with a serious problem, a productivity problem. But don't worry, HubSpot's customer platform can help. No more time-consuming tasks, no more chasing down prospect info, no more one system for this, another for that. HubSpot helps you find leads, reach prospects, and deliver the insights to convert them into customers all in one place, making your productivity problem no problem at all. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better.
Yeah. And I love this, and I want to take this two ways, right? So what you're pointing to, one is, I guess, from a human element as a leader, as an individual, how you can apply that in your leadership to be more likable and relatable. And on the other as well, in terms of building your brand a little bit more intentionally. So let's start with part one. One of the things that I struggle with, I mean, you know the work that I do. I look at, how do we address the gender venture funding gap? And one of the key issues that we see, and an example I like to use, which is still the case, is women applying for job will only raise their hand if they feel like they were 110% qualified, right? That they meet all the requirements. Whereas men more likely will say, and there are studies that show this, you know, if you meet 65%, yeah, I'm the man, I've got this, I'll learn on the job. How do you think we can shift this thinking where, you know, the woman still feels that she has to hide all her flaws, be as perfect as possible. And yet for men, it's the opposite. Does this still apply, you know, taking into account gender stereotypes that exist?
Oh, I mean, yeah, there's if you read about behavioral science, you will completely understand that gender stereotypes, gender biases are an incredibly large problem within hiring today. Endless studies showcase how when you attempt to hide gender during the interview process, you end up getting far better candidates and a far better balance of diversity as well. And every study will tell you that a diverse team is a high performing team, is a much more high performing team. You know, there's the infamous study, the famous study with orchestras, where when orchestras made their interview process blind, the number of females in the orchestra increased dramatically. So all they were doing was asking the violinist to perform behind a curtain rather than perform out in the open. And when you just listen to the sound of the violinist, you can rank them without being biased by their race, their gender, whatever else. And that's a fantastic example of how blind interviews are a really powerful way to beat these biases. But it's not the only way. There's evidence, there's some studies that suggest that the type of language we use in our job descriptions can change how likely people are to go for the job. So language which is, you know, based around power and control and dominating language appeals more to individuals who feel connected to those types of adjectives. So unfortunately that tends to be men. So if you contain language within your job description about being a powerful manager or a manager that can truly lead a team and delegate, using these terms that appeal to men, you end up getting men far more likely to apply. Whereas if you use terms that are more gender neutral, or perhaps even terms that appeal more to women, and again, huge yeah, like stereotypes in both of these.
Yeah, I was going to offer a study that I looked at recently was the use of the word ninja. So of course, you know, in the world of tech, Silicon Valley, right, we are all about hustle culture, which needs to change. And, you know, there was a couple of job descriptions using the word ninja, but women do not associate with themselves being ninjas. So once they remove that terminology, it actually changed the results. So exactly what you were saying. I had actually Michelle Walker, who coined the term the gray rhino. So she's a risk expert thinking about risk, right? And one of the things that we talked about was stereotype threat, and that a lot of language that you point to pushes women to be branded as, you know, risk averse, when really studies show that there is no real difference between women and men. And the reality is that we're not comparing apples to apples. I mean, can a woman, I guess, taking into account what you said, still be seen to be competent while revealing her flaws? I mean, there's always a fear here that, you know, she has to be perfect. Do you think that plays out in any way?
Yeah, I mean, so you're asking, would the pratfall effect be as effective for women as it is for men? I think that's an interesting question. I'm pretty sure the studies that Jo Sylvester ran, she's a female researcher, I believe, from Swansea University, did include women. So pretty sure that peer-reviewed study would hold up evidence. I think the fact is that you've got to take into account that these biases do exist anyway, and the level upon which the effect will have for a woman versus a man is probably different. I'll reveal my own weakness here, Sarah, and be very transparent about the fact that I haven't done enough research into gender imbalance. I haven't done enough research into hiring processes, and I haven't done enough research into, you know, being a female leader, and I can't speak from experience. So I probably don't have as much as I would love to say on the topic, but I think the evidence definitely suggests that these effects are powerful for both men and women. They have an effect across genders, across society, across race as well. But you've also got to take into account that the effect is not always the same amount. While it might boost one person by 2x, it might only boost another's likelihood of getting an interview by 1.5x, for example. So I think understanding all of that within context is important.
I love that to be the next episode on Nudge, and I'll be happy to help you out there. I've got a ton of research to dig into. Now let's go to part two, which is really making brands relatable, right? I think one of the things that I was really fascinated in what you uncovered was how many brands actually put human-like figures that you can associate. Talk to us a little bit about that effect and how leaders should be thinking about building their brands here.
Yeah, so this is something that I think all of us notice, but we don't think anything about. We don't think about why Tony the Tiger has a human face to put on the Frosties logo, why there's Pringles has a face on it, Foot Locker has a face on it, Green Giant has a face on it, McDonald's has a face, you know, all these characters associated with brands. It's something that is commonplace from Colonel Sanders to Johnny Walker. You know, we're used to it, but we don't really think about it. And I didn't think about it myself until I interviewed a brilliant researcher called Aaron Ahuvia on Nudge. And he talked to me about anthropomorphic thinking. And anthropomorphic thinking is this idea that we have positive associations towards other humans and positive associations towards faces. And when something appears to look like a face, we change how much we might like that thing. So there's this brilliant study with Christopher Bartnek in the University of Canterbury. And in his study, he had a sort of cat robot sitting next to the participant's computer. And the cat robot could sort of talk to the participant. So you can look up a YouTube video of this study. It doesn't really talk. It sort of, you know, pleads in a robotic style. Really doesn't seem very human. But it has a face, has like a smiley face with eyes. And even though it's a robot, has this face. And he asks the participants to do a few simple tasks with the cat. The goal of the task is to be as quick as possible. So the participants are getting paid based on how quick they are. And then at the end, and this is still timed, he says, you know, can you please unplug the cat as quickly as possible? And what happens when he says this is he plays a recording on the cat, and the cat starts to plead for its life. It starts to say, please don't turn me off. Please keep me on. Please, I'll just be quiet. Honestly, like, I'll just be quiet. You can tell the researcher you told me off. I'll just be quiet. And, you know, this is a simple task. It's the equivalent of unplugging your toaster. You and I could do that in a second. And yeah, what Christopher Bartnek found was that participants were either very, very slow to unplug the robot, or they didn't at all. They lied and kept the robot plugged in. And it's, you know, this is this idea that when objects, like a brand, like a product, have these human connotations, have a human face, or perhaps talk like a human, we treat them differently. And you can link this to many, many things. So slot machines, for example, this is studies in casinos, slot machines that look like they have a human face. So perhaps just the way it's designed, it looks like there are two eyes in the top right-hand corner, it looks like there's a nose perhaps in the middle, and then a big smiley face where the money comes out. Individuals who rank highly on their feeling of dominance and their feeling that they can manipulate other people will end up playing those slot machines far more than any other slot machines, simply because they look at them and they think, oh, that's a human face and I can manipulate people, so I can manipulate this slot machine. Other studies with cookies find that if you put a smiley face on a cookie, people are far more likely to eat that cookie. And in fact, after they're asked, why did you eat that cookie? Some even identify it and they say, oh, you know, it had a smiley face. It was almost like it was asking me to eat it. So there's all these evidence that basically if something has a human face, or if something appears to have human quantities, we view it differently. We end up liking it more. We end up potentially doing the thing it asks. And if it asks us not to turn it off, we might do that. And if it asks us, like Pringles does, tells us once we pop, we can't stop, we're far more likely to do that as well. So that's the reason why so many brands have human-like characteristics and human-like mascots.
So tactically speaking, I guess, in implementing in the app businesses for the leaders tuning in, it would be in thinking about ways you can humanize mm-hmm. the brands that you create and really almost like mascots, right? It's having an iconic character that you can recognize. But beyond, I guess, iconic characters, what comes to mind is also taglines, right? I think a couple that come to mind, because you're worth it, just do it, right? How do you think about building taglines that are sticky?
Yeah, well, firstly, around anthropomorphic thinking, there's this great study around the language you use in your taglines and around human language versus technical language. And I'm going to forget the words, but it was a study that was done with iPhones, and they showed two different types of iPhone ads to people. And some of the ads used purely technical language, and some of the other ads, or the A-B tests, the B ads, used more humanized language. Rather than saying the iPhone has an incredible processor, it'll say the iPhone's got great intelligence, or it's just had an IQ boost, or, you know, it can see further if the camera's got better. So he's talking about it in kind of human terms. And it turned out that language, humanizing that language, made that copy far more effective. Upon the same lines, there's a lot of study around concrete phrases. So this is a brilliant work by Christopher Begg. And he gave participants lists of phrases to try and remember. This is extremely important for folks trying to come up with a tagline. And these phrases were either phrases you could visualize, like square door, or brown horse. And then some phrases were phrases that you weren't able to visualize. So a phrase like unique idea or ambiguous quantity. And he asked them to remember these phrases, came back to them later in the day and asked, how many do you remember? And I think it was something to the effect of four times, that people were four times more likely to remember the concrete phrases, to remember phrases you can visualize. And this is especially important when it comes to tagline. The best example of this is MP3 players in the early 2000s. So MP3 players were dominated by Samsung and Philips and Sony, and they all in their advertisements talked about the technical elements that they had in their MP3 player. You know, they would say, we've got 250 megabytes worth of storage. We've got brilliant Hertz quality playback, so you can listen to all your songs at such high quality. And then iPhone came into the market and they didn't talk about any of that. They just used a simple concrete phrase and they said 1,000 songs in your pocket. And that's a very simple application of Christopher Beck's theory, that if you use concrete language, you're far more likely to be remembered, far more likely to be recalled. And it's no surprise when you compare those ads side by side that Apple did so well. You know, if you say 250 megabytes, who's going to remember that? If you say 1,000 songs, well, I can visualize 1,000 songs and I'm far more likely to buy an iPod when I see that ad.
And this brings to the thinking of almost, I guess, keeping it as simple as possible and thinking from the perspective of a consumer, right? With, not necessarily sharing the product specs that don't matter or that they can't visualize to be impacting their lives versus 1,000 songs in their pocket. I mean, this is a very important concept because a lot of the challenges actually we see with startups is, you know, a lot of them are product builders. So they're obsessed about their products, the technical capabilities and the upgrades and how it has been improved from one version to the other. But it's almost like they built first before actually building into product market fit, which is a common reason that a lot of products fail. How have you seen brands or companies do this in a way that really thinks from the consumer first and implement it so that they're able to scale well?
Yeah, so this is my job as a product marketer. We're doing this at Buffer right now. We're trying to think about, okay, what's the value that Buffer, a social media scheduling company, provides? Is it that it can schedule your social media posts exactly when you want? Is it that it has great API links with Twitter and Meta and Instagram and LinkedIn? No. What it really is a tool to help you grow your following, because that's the outcome that people want. People don't want to be able to, you know, have scheduled posts that go out on time. Well, maybe they partially do, but the real thing they want, the real reason why they're doing that, is to grow their following, create click-worthy content, and save more time as well. So we've completely shifted our marketing to highlight those three jobs to be done. And that's completely in line with this concrete. The company I love most, a startup company, well, it's no longer a startup, it's doing very well, but they understood this from day one. And it was a brilliant company. It's a company called Loom. And Loom let you record videos of yourself, send them very quickly via a browser-based or a URL-based, a unique URL. You can record a video of you and your screen, send it via URL to someone. Very easy way to send a video message. Now, sending a video message is hardly a new thing, right? This product came about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Sending a video message has been around for ages. We can do it on our phones. We can do it with all sorts of different tools we have. We can do it in Zoom. We can do it in the tool we're using now. You know, it's very easy to send a video message. And Loom have yet somehow managed to dominate the market. And I think a big part of that is because of the taglines and the marketing they used. When they went to market, they didn't say, oh, we allow you to record in 1080p HD, or we'll give you 16 gigabytes of storage, or we source everything in local clouds, which make it faster to showcase your videos, because they know nobody cares about that. They know that's not what interests people. So instead, rather than thinking of all the technical achievements that they've done, they think, okay, what does the customer get from this? What the customer gets is no more meetings. It's the ability to stop being in meetings and to simply share a message over a quick Loom rather than having to do a 30-minute meeting. So all of Loom's initial advertising, and I believe they're still using this today in their positioning and messaging, is don't join meetings, just send a Loom. This can eradicate your calendar. It can completely drop down the amount of time you spend in meeting, and you can save far more time to get back to the work that you have to do. And so Loom, rather than being positioned against Skype and Zoom and all these other video tools, is simply positioned as an alternative to a meeting. And that's a market where they're far more likely to win. The product that can kill meetings is a product that people will use. The product that has 10 gigabytes of storage is one that gets forgotten.
Yeah, I love that. I'm taking copious notes here, you know, about thinking in outcomes, right? Jobs to be done. I mean, that's a common word that we use, but really, what are the jobs that your consumers, your end users, your beneficiaries are looking to achieve? And and how can you really use that in your marketing as in the way that Loom has done. And interestingly, what Loom has also evidenced is really being very specific and focused, right? I think these days, one of the challenges that a lot of startups, technologies, products that are being built today is they can have so many different use cases, right? And it's a challenge to figure out, do I go horizontal? Do I go vertical? Do I start with one or do I start broadly? What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, so I lean a lot on April Dunford's positioning work. So April Dunford, she is a brilliant positioning messaging expert. She's written a fantastic book called Obviously Awesome. And she helps marketers like me come up with positioning. And one of the rules she has in her positioning framework is don't try and be everything for everyone. Because by going broad and going wide, you only end up not really appealing to any specific group. She says, find the thing that is uniquely beneficial to the audience you want to go after and focus solely on that. And there are so many wonderful applications of this. There's a brilliant houseplant company here in the UK, and they sell houseplants. And you might think that they would talk about all of the different plants they have on offer. You might think that they would talk about all of the, you know, deals and discounts that they have, but they don't talk about that at all. Instead, they say almost unkillable plants. So they are solely trying to sell themselves to people.
That's for me. I need
to
that.
People who have houseplants that die. Yeah, that's who they sell themselves to. And that means that they are turning off a large swathe of buyers. That means they're turning off people with green fingers, people who really love plants, people who spend a lot of time caring for them. They are happily turning away that audience in order to win others. Standing for something is a fantastic way to actually benefit. You know, the only real brands that go really broad, a giant FMCGs who really can appeal to a whole swathe of people, even they find value in getting specific. Take the Coke campaign where Coke put the names of individual people on their cans. That's a great example of Coke trying to go really narrow and change their messaging so they appeal to individual people. But yeah, focusing your message like the plants company did, saying we create almost unkillable plants, is far better than saying we create plants for every house, for example.
You did, I guess, cover a little bit about using marketing and messaging language. And it's undeniable that culture is part of that, right? You even talked about how, in many ways, the marketing campaigns built culture or were part and parcel of that culture. And I guess the question I have a lot of times for marketers is, where does the responsibility lie here? You know, how do you think about the fact that you're using all these tools in the toolkit, right? To influence consumers, to influence a culture?
It's a really good question. Are we comfortable with brands persuading us to do things? Because that's the world we live in at the moment. That's what we have grown to accept. We expect advertising. You know, we all use Instagram and Facebook and Twitter with the expectation, Twitter less so these days, but with the expectation that it is free in order to watch ads. And because we watch ads, we know that there's a chance we'll be influenced by these things. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think, you know, that's a fundamental part to make capitalism work. It allows new companies to come about. The ability to advertise allows people to reach new audiences, and so on and so forth. And like you say, ads become a huge part of our culture. It's easy for people to recall lots of infamous ads and lots of brand figures. I would argue to a point that more people would recognize Colonel Sanders if you put a couple of pictures up than perhaps their local MP in the UK or their local congressman in the States. So we are heavily influenced by ads as well. That said, and I think, and this is something important for marketers to bear in mind, is to use that influence, you know, wisely. You know, you should be using that influence with the expectation that you shouldn't be doing things unethical. De Beers created this necessity to buy a diamond engagement ring when people propose. That's all through their advertising. And ads ultimately have dictated who we pick in elections. You know, there are infamous ads from Lyndon Johnson's Daisy ad where a young girl counts down from 10 and the nuclear bomb goes off, and that encouraged people to vote for Lyndon Johnson in a time of real fear around nukes. And the same could be said for Kennedy. His famous picture of Nixon saying, "Would you buy a used car from this man?" inspired millions of people to vote for Kennedy. So look, ads can be very influential. They can be very powerful. They should be used wisely because ultimately they can form aspects of our culture and our society.
Yeah, and that brings me very nicely actually to what is definitely in the minds of our culture today, and that is AI, right, in marketing. Are you worried about AI taking over your job, Phil?
Oh yeah, big time. I'm very worried, yeah.
Where do you think AI is really going to change things in the future for brands and marketing and things like that.
I think AI ultimately will make a lot of marketing tasks redundant, unfortunately. I think, you know, it will remove a lot of the weight from the role. And hopefully that'll mean it will free marketers up to do other things. Hopefully that'll mean that marketers can become far more specialist. They can become far more knowledgeable. You know, perhaps marketers on your team will be experts in pricing psychology and experts in buyer psychology or experts in persuasion tactics. And then you can use the AI to go and create a huge email campaign or write a bunch of copy for you based on those inputs. But yeah, I can imagine AI becoming far more influential than it currently is. A big thing I worry about with AI is how much marketers will lean on it. So there is endless evidence from the world of behavioral science that we prefer the easy option. We take the easy option, whether that is fast food or Amazon one-click delivery or instant loans with high interest rates. We often go for the easy option, and making something easy is a really fast way to change people's decisions. And the fear with AI is that it would be very easy for marketers to use. And I think it's already seeing it within marketing teams at the moment and within businesses at the moment. There's this ease of use with AI. It's very easy for it to just write a really quick blog post. The fear I have is that that might ultimately decrease the effectiveness of all of our work, because we'll opt for that easy choice when the longer, harder choice might take a bit longer. The one other thing I think about a lot with AI is, you know, how much people will value content when they know it's written by AI. There's a lot of psychology behind wanting to understand the effort and labor that's gone into something. And if we know something has been written in seconds by AI, we will value it far, far less. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that. So if emails do end up getting written by AI and the consumer knows that, that's potentially going to make that email, for example, and you can share that with lots of different other mediums, but that'll make it far less effective. And that's a fear I think marketers should have.
And I love actually that example of the psychology of labor and value. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So I think this is really interesting for a lot of your listeners. So when you're making big decisions at companies and you're trying to influence people to do something, one of the easiest ways you can persuade people that the decision you're suggesting is a good decision is by showing the amount of labor you've put in to creating that decision. So these are studies, lots of different studies have been run on it. One of the most famous is with real estate agents. In this study, they got real estate agents to give a list of houses to prospective buyers and say, you know, here are the houses I've come up with for you. How relevant are they for you? In some scenarios, the estate agent would say, oh, I spent all of last night working on this list. It took me 9 hours. I really hope you like the list. I really hope you like the houses. In other scenarios, the real estate agent would say, oh, I used the computer to help out with this one. It only took me an hour. Really hope you like the houses. And it turns out when people hear the labor that's gone into the work, when they hear that somebody has spent all night working on that list, they value those same houses far higher. They're far more likely to go and visit them, far more likely to make an offer. And so showing the labor you put into something makes people value it more. Showing the labor you put into creating food makes people enjoy it more. When you watch a chef, this is studies that have been cited in HBR, when you watch a chef create your meal, you will rate that meal as being more enjoyable. You'll rate it as being higher quality. And you can apply this same thing to business. Steve Jobs was fantastic at this. Almost every keynote, he would start by saying, we've spent the last 2 years working on this product and I can't wait to show it to you today. He does that repeatedly in a way which makes you realize that he understood the labor illusion. He understood that showing the effort that goes into something makes people value it more. And I think it's really important for leaders out there to remember, because if you are trying to raise funding, for example, going out and talking about the lines of code, the huge number of lines of code that your folks have written, the huge number of product releases that you've worked on, the number of users that you've got, and how many people you've helped influence and helped out with your product.
Love that. And I guess we've...
Hey, we're taking a quick break here so I can tell you about this new show that just joined our network. Created, hosted by John Yushai, is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. Created gives an insight look at how to build a business as a creator, improve your creative process, and stay ahead of the latest content trends. John Yushai, ex-YouTube and Instagram employee, breaks down the creator economy with guests like Logan Paul, Paris Hilton, Jason Derulo, Jake Paul, George Lopez, and so much more. A not so recent episode I loved was actually the one with Liza Koshy. Remember her? She was one of the fastest growing YouTubers and Viners, if you remember that, growing a fan base well beyond 25 million subscribers. But then she stopped uploading. What happened to Liza Koshy? That's a smart woman who made a drastic career decision, what I may call a billion-dollar move. You'd want to tune in to this one. Listen to Created wherever you get your podcasts.
Covered quite a lot of ground here, from, you know, labor and value to the misconceptions in marketing, building trust. As we wrap here, if there's nothing else but this one thing, a key takeaway that you want leaders tuning in to implement in their businesses, in their leadership, what would that be?
Yeah, I'll take it right back to the start. I think highlighting your weaknesses is a powerful thing, and showcasing your flaws is a really useful thing for leaders to remember. I think some of the greatest leaders of our time have been able to admit when they're wrong. And that's valuable, not just because it helps them make better decisions, but because it really does make people warm to them. It really does make people appreciate them. And the same can be true for brands as well. I think when brands realize they've made a mistake, and highlighting that and showcasing and perhaps apologizing, that can be beneficial too. Hiding your weaknesses, showing purely strength, is not always the best thing to do. And there are dozens of examples I can give to end on, but I think, yeah, that's the takeaway I'd want people to have.
Yeah, love that. Well, Phil, really enjoyed this wide-ranging conversation. A lot more rabbit holes that I would love to go deep on, but of course, we can tune into all of that on your podcast. Tell us where we can find it and a little bit more of a pitch about your work.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. Yeah, just search for Nudge wherever you get your podcasts. You'll see a nice orange logo. That's my logo. And tune into Nudge. Lots of episodes on there you might like. One that new listeners tend to really enjoy is a deep dive I did on Steve Jobs. I've mentioned him there. I think your listeners would really love that one.
Great. Awesome, Phil. Well, thank you so much for your time, for your insights, and for making Billion Dollar Moves.
And thanks so much for tuning in this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow our socials on Sarah Chen Global to get the latest on the show. It would really help me out too if you enjoyed this to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts and share your favorite episodes with a friend. I'm Sarah Chen Spellings, and you've been listening to Billion Dollar Moves.